Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borut in Bonn. On today's program, will the broom revolution in Georgia sweep out its long-standing president? France's new president is facing a crisis of his own 4 months into office.
Hollande's personal popularity rating is not the only thing that he has to worry about either. 68% of the French now say they're pessimistic about the future. That's the highest ever figure for the first months of a new presidency in any case.
Also on the show, Spain is struggling to educate its youth in the face of sharp budget cuts. And we pay a visit to Brussels to see where MEPs hang out after work. Those stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. Georgia is set to go to polls this Monday to elect a new parliament. The poll comes as a scandal has broken out concerning conditions at one of the country's prisons. Images that were released on TV last week showed systematic abuse and torture of inmates. And in response, Georgians took to the streets in outrage. Longstanding President Mikhail Saakashvili is in damage control mode now in a bid to avert his worst political crisis since the war with Russia in 2008. But as our correspondent Paul Rimpel reports from Tbilisi, those efforts may be too little, too late.
This footage of a prisoner getting beaten by a dozen guards in a Tbilisi prison was broadcast on television last week. It sent shockwaves across the country. More clips followed showing inmates being raped with batons and brooms, which sparked nationwide protests and drew international condemnation. The event couldn't have come at a worse time for Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili, who is battling his first real contender for power in an extremely heated October 1st contest. Saakashvili, long considered a pro-democratic leader in the West, is being challenged by Bidzina Ivanishvili, a billionaire who accuses the president and his administration of being authoritarian tyrants.
The only man who was ideologically planning this was Saakashvili, the person who was torturing. He's not a normal person because normal people don't do this. Who has gathered such a team? It's coming from the top.
Saakashvili has blamed the timely video leak on a Russian conspiracy, but has conceded that ignoring years of reports on abuses was a grave mistake. As a result, Corrections Minister Hatuna Kalmakalidze resigned. She was soon followed by Interior Minister Bacho Akhalaya, who was prison chief between 2005 and 2008. It was under his watch that Georgia grew to have the fourth largest incarceration rate in the world. Akhalaya is considered the architect of a policy of systematic violence against the country's inmates, and for many people, his resignation is not enough.
Who gave them permission to beat them? Whoever beat them should be put in a circle and beaten too. When we saw this on TV, tears poured from our eyes.
This woman is one of over 100 mothers, sisters, and wives who are keeping a vigil at Goldani Prison No. 8, where the footage was filmed. Maya Giorgadze nods her head and agrees. Her son has been imprisoned for 6 months on drug charges. She has been at the prison gates day and night since she heard of the videos.
We want more amnesty. They're butchers. They're still there. We're told that they're not, but they are still there. We know from the prisoners. We want them all arrested, not only fired from their jobs, but arrested. We want them to answer before the law for what they were doing. We demand justice.
If Saakashvili's party wins a majority of the seats, justice may be hard to get. Georgia's courts have a 99.7 prosecution rate and are notorious for their lack of independence. His appointment of Ombudsman Gheorghe Tugushi, who is critical of the human rights conditions in penitentiaries, is not enough to convince many Georgians that the justice system will improve. In Georgia, family members are allowed visits once a month. One man has stood by the Goldani Prison No. 8 gate daily to be close to his son. He is afraid to reveal his name because he fears retribution against his son.
I don't believe Tugushi. He's Saakashvili's man. Saakashvili should choose somebody from the opposition, then I'd believe. Tugushi will do something, but he won't be able to change the system until everyone who gave the orders are punished.
Georgia's high incarceration rate means that everybody has a relative or somebody close to them in jail, which explains why the scandal has resonated so deeply in society. Ivanishvili says the scandal has more significance in the West than in Georgia because Georgians already know how brutal Saakashvili's administration is. From a banquet table in eastern Georgia, the billionaire declares his party will win by 80% and establish truly democratic institutions. The judiciary, he says confidently, will be no problem to reform. Paul Rimple, DW Radio, Tbilisi.
The troubles in Georgia may be far more acute, but France's president, François Hollande, is dealing with a crisis of his own at the moment. Hollande is fresh in office after defeating Nicolas Sarkozy with ease in elections in May. But just 4 months later, the socialist president is facing disastrous approval ratings. He's dropped 11 percentage points since the election, which is one of the steepest declines of any French president over the past half century. With much of southern Europe dealing with angry citizens at the moment, is this something Hollande should be worried about, as he too is forced to present deep austerity cuts to his people? Or is it natural for the new president? I put that question to our Paris correspondent, John Lawrenson.
No, these ratings really are pretty bad. I mean, his predecessor, Nicolas Sarkozy, he became the most unpopular president France had ever known, ever since the start of their very presidential Fifth Republic regime in 1958, in any case. And Hollande's personal popularity rating is not the only thing that he has to worry about either. And 68% of the French now say they're pessimistic about the future. That's the highest ever figure for the first months of a new presidency, in any case.
What has he done, or rather not done, to deserve this disastrous drop?
Well, look, he's only been in power for 4 months, obviously, and so it's, you know, unfair to judge his record too much. But cast your mind back to the election campaign and Hollande's campaign slogan. Do you remember that one? Le changement c'est maintenant, change it's now. Well, I think in France today, I think people are fewer than ever who believe that change is really going to happen now, or rather, they do believe that change is going to happen now, but things are going to get worse because the tax burden, they're worried about that. The tax burden on workers and job creators in France is increasing, and France is getting less and less competitive. I mean, I think if voters thought Hollande could stop France's industrial decline, then they'll have been very disappointed with what happened this summer at Aulnay. That's where car maker Peugeot announced that it was going to close down a factory making 8,000 people redundant. I mean, Hollande first said his first reaction to that was it's unacceptable, and later he just had to back down. He just had to change that into inevitable. So there is a growing impression, I think, here, Gabriel, that there is a presidential powerlessness.
Well, John, as the economy stagnates, does France still have the authority to maintain its role alongside Germany as the motor of Europe?
Well, I think the short answer to that is no. I mean, authority is something you earn, literally earn. And as the French economy falters, as you say, well, its authority is going to have to diminish. I mean, luckily for France, a lot of other countries, Britain, the United States, for example, aren't doing too well. Let's not even mention what's happening in the south of Europe. I mean, Germany is doing better, of course, and feels also, I suppose, less bound by its Nazi past, less bound then to play a small, discreet role in the world of in world politics. I mean, there is still a Franco-German motor, but it's, you know, you could say it's a Mercedes on one side and a little Renault 5 on the other.
You mentioned the tough times in southern Europe at the moment. There's been a load of austerity cuts that have led to anger on the streets there. Will Hollande's budget also result in social unrest?
It'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously, the unions don't want to shoot themselves in the foot. They don't want to do anything life-threatening for the Hollande government, which is, you know, a left-wing government after all. But there is still a sizable extreme-left rump in French politics, led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, as you know. And as Hollande's political capital diminishes, I think he'll be tempted to become more and more critical. The trade union movement as well in France, there's not very many people in trade unions. It's not terribly representative of the workforce over here. That is why it is very strongly marked by the extreme left, by the Communist Party in particular. Communist Party activists have traditionally played a very large role in trade union politics and in trade union opposition to governments in France. And I think this opposition is bound to become more and more vocal. So the fact that we have a left-wing government in power does not mean there won't be a serious challenge from the street.
Just before we go, from a personal standpoint, John, do you think the French see a leader in Hollande? At least internationally, he's kept a pretty low profile, certainly compared to Sarkozy.
Well, he's not the sort of leader that the French usually say they want. I'm more of a compromise man, a committee man, a consensus politician of the sort you might find in Scandinavia, for example. He's called himself, as you know, a very famous phrase, the normal president, a normal president, he says. And this was attractive for the French, I think, when Nicolas Sarkozy was in power. But now that he's gone, Hollande's normality looks more like absence or insufficiency, and what looked like moderation or reasonableness, if that's the word, when he was facing Sarkozy, now looks more like indecision, even impotence. François Hollande's decline in the opinion polls has begun in earnest, and it's far from over, I think.
Our France correspondent John Lawrenson there, speaking from Paris. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. In Spain this week, thousands of people rallied outside Parliament in Madrid, and police responded by firing rubber bullets into the crowds. They shouted, "We are not afraid," and called for an end to the government, which wants to slash public spending by some 40 billion euros next year. Spain has already been deeply affected by austerity measures, with one of the biggest victims being public education. Schools have now reopened for the new semester, but the classes are bigger, the teachers fewer, and fees for things like school lunch and books much higher. Lauren Freyer reports now from Madrid on how some families are coping.
13-year-old Alvaro Laje and his friends crowd outside their Madrid school on the first day of classes, discussing what happened over summer vacation. The city started construction on a parking garage where they used to play football.
It's the yard where we used to play football and basketball. They got rid of it just to make some extra money, to build a parking lot. So now we can't play outside. We'll have to stay in class.
Besides collecting fees for parking, the boys' school is saving money by requiring teachers to work longer hours for less pay. Some are even forced to teach outside their areas of expertise, says one of Alvaro's classmates, 15-year-old Gonzalo Villa.
Ahora por los recortes.
With all the budget cuts, the French teacher is now giving English lessons, and the math teacher is also teaching physics, and the technology teacher is doing math. This is the way it is now.
This is the first full school year since the biggest public education cuts in Spain's democratic history. 20% of the education budget is slated to disappear by 2015. For the first time in 14 years, the number of teachers is down through layoffs and attrition, even as student enrollment rises. That has parents like Conchi Redondo worried.
I have three daughters in school, and this year there are no more discounts for school lunch, books, or anything.
Redondo's family used to qualify for a discount on school lunch, but that subsidy has been cut this year. So has a discount on books.
For one student at my daughter's school, it cost 125 euros a month for school lunch. 125 euros! And for the books, I spent 600 euros for all three of them.
Even if they bring food from home, Redondo's daughters will have to pay a fee just to eat their bagged lunches in the cafeteria with other kids. Pablo Aznar is a primary school teacher who has had to break the news of these new fees to parents, many of whom have lost their jobs in the past year. Spain has Europe's highest unemployment rate, about 25%.
It's like a ball in my throat. It's a tragedy. It's because you see the drama in the families. I wish I have lots of money, and the only thing that we do in our case is think 100% how to save money for the families. If we have to go on a trip, we'll try to search the cheapest place. We work a lot on that.
Aznar teaches in Madrid but lives nearby in the region of Castilla-La Mancha, where 60 schools closed for good this summer. Some 8-year-olds now have to ride a bus 40 kilometers to school when they used to be able to walk. Such budget cuts have already prompted one teacher's strike in Madrid just a week into the school year, and more are planned. Anger is understandable, says economist Gonzalo Garland at Madrid's IE Business School. With cuts to education and healthcare, Spanish austerity threatens the very heart of Europe's post-war welfare state, he says.
Well, probably there is also some inefficiencies. The public sector in Europe has been maybe too many free things, but the cuts there are very painful. No? When VAT goes up, well, people might complain, we don't like it too much, but it's unavoidable. But when there's cuts in education, cuts in health, it's your children, it's just a welfare state that is being destroyed, that creates a lot of resistance.
Back outside his middle school in Madrid, the teenager Alvaro Laje bemoans the surprise loss of his schoolyard being turned into a parking garage.
We've only got 30 minutes for recess, and we'll have to stay inside for it this year. This is how the crisis hurts our quality of life.
Union leaders predict more unhappy surprises in Spanish schools throughout this school year. Lauren Freyer, DW Madrid.
Now, if after these past reports you have the impression that Europe is a continent of crisis, unrest, and general doom and gloom, we can't exactly blame you. But not to worry, in our next report, you will not hear the words austerity, anger, or protests. I promise. At the political center of Europe these days, there's a lot of hustle and bustle. Brussels is where Europe's parliamentarians do their work, and not surprisingly, it's also where they hang out. Place de Luxembourg, or Place Lux, is the picturesque square right near the parliament, and this is where the MEPs definitely do hang out, at least on weeknights, as Joe Impey tells us in this postcard.
Place du Luxembourg, or Place Lux as it's known, was described by one former member of the European Parliament as being the beating heart of EU Brussels. On a weekend, you'd be forgiven for wondering why. The picturesque square is lined with rows of cafes and bars, but aside from a few bumbling tourists, the place is all but deserted. Come here on a weeknight, however, and it's transformed. Hundreds of young professionals from the neighbouring European Parliament gather here to discuss the latest EU gossip over a drink or a meal. The MEPs and their assistants are joined by swarms of diplomats, company executives and journalists, all armed with stacks of business cards and endless charm. As the cocktails, wine and beer start flowing, the networking begins in earnest. In the last 10 years or so, as the powers of the European Parliament have expanded, so too is the presence of lobbyists and lawyers in the Place Lux area. With thousands of people working in the Parliament, it's become a natural place to make contacts and have a good time. Place Lux has been likened to K Street in Washington, D.C., a well-known centre for think tanks and lobbyists. In Brussels, interest groups have established their bases in the streets surrounding Place du Luxembourg, and the square is where they peddle their trade. Here, it's handy to be multilingual. With people from all 27 EU member states working in the European institutions, you'll hear a different language at every table. You won't find many real Bruxellois venturing out here. It's almost become an expat enclave. The funny thing is that it's hardest to find a seat on a Thursday night, not Friday, as you might think. That's partly because everyone's taking advantage of cheap happy hour offers, and partly because most of the parliamentary business takes place from Monday to Thursday to allow MEPs time to travel to their constituencies for the weekend. So Thursday's the day when everyone's keen to let off steam. Ralph's Bar encapsulates the spirit of Place Lux. If you pass by there early on a weekday evening, you'll see people dressed in smart office gear with wine or beer glasses in hand. They gather in small groups around high tables on the terrace. And if the Brussels weather is looking a bit grey, as it often is, there are waterproof coverings to keep the rain off. Apparently, those who frequent Ralph's tend to be on the right of the political spectrum. The left of centre crowd heads to the Pullman, which is the bar right next door. When I was there, I couldn't tell the difference, to be honest. But if you're at all involved in the European machine, you may even spot some familiar faces in the crowd. If, however, you're more interested in the food than the politics, there are cafes and restaurants clustered around the square which offer food to suit most tastes, though perhaps not surprisingly, some of the menus are a bit pricey. Once you've had your fill of all that Brussels babble, you can easily hop on one of the buses which run through the square, whisking you away from the European Quarter and into the centre of the city. Or perhaps, if you're a VIP, you can just take a cab from one of the taxi ranks. Joanna Impey, DW, Brussels.
We invite you to visit our page to read Joe's online report. You'll find it under our scene in Europe at dw.de/Europe. And now it's time for this month's quiz on Inside Europe. Two hundred years ago this month, it was the beginning of the end for Napoleon's invasion of Russia. His army won the Battle of Borodino on September 7th and continued its march into Moscow. But a ruined city awaited them, and Napoleon was forced to retreat. It's one of the most important events in Russian history and inspired one of Tchaikovsky's most well-known pieces of music, the 1812 Overture. But do you know this version of the 1812 Overture? It's just been released by an American band to coincide with the anniversary. And for this month's quiz, we want you to tell us the name of the band. Is it A, Napoleon's Revenge? B, the Invincible Tsars? Or C, the Revolting Peasants? I'll repeat those. A, Napoleon's Revenge, B, the Invincible Tsars, or C, the Revolting Peasants. Send your answer to europe@dw.de or write to us at Inside Europe, the European Desk, DW, Bonn, Germany. We'll announce our five winners in October. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. Thank you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. Over the next half hour, is Denmark sending Guatemalan transvestites to their deaths? King Richard III, the man who would have given his kingdom for a horse, has got residents in Leicester buzzing.
We've got a hole, we've got some bones, and we don't know. We've got to wait until the DNA comes through. It's exciting if it is Richard. It's even more exciting if it isn't in some ways.
And when it comes to email behavior, what kind of bird are you? Intrigued? It'll all make sense later on Inside Europe. As you heard there, we're going to head first to Denmark, where two transvestites, or transgender individuals as they're called, are fighting for asylum. The pair is from Guatemala, and they're afraid of being sent home, where just this year alone, 17 transgender individuals have been murdered in hate crimes. Activists are striving to prevent the deportation, which they say would contradict Denmark's pledge to uphold human rights. Our correspondent Malcolm Brabant met the two would-be asylum seekers in the Danish capital and has this report.
Destination Copenhagen. The central station is awash with people on the move. Once this country had a generous open-door policy towards foreigners seeking refuge from war and other forms of persecution. But in recent years, Denmark has been far less welcoming, as Fernanda Milan found out. Fernanda is dressed and made up as a woman. She dreaded being deported to her native Guatemala, where once she was a target for bigotry and violence.
In spite of all the attacks that I have experienced, the last one was by a police officer. And in previous years, other girls or teen girls from the organization has been assassinated and executed by police members. So I was afraid of my life, and that makes me want to run away from my country.
Just days before being deported, Fernanda received a last-minute reprieve from the Danish authorities, who promised to re-examine her case. Campaigners working on behalf of Fernanda and a fellow asylum seeker highlighted recent statistics which showed that 17 transgender individuals were murdered in Guatemala in the first 5 months of this year. Stina Larsen is one of a number of activists working on the Guatemalans' behalf.
It's important because if Fernanda and Paula go back, I'm totally sure they will get killed. It's not something I think, I'm sure.
Stina's colleague is Emil Kronjäger.
I'm actually terrified that this at all should be a question. Our foreign policies are supporting human rights in all over the world. But when it comes down to giving a single person asylum that is so obviously persecuted, the politic is totally being ignored and human rights are practically being violated.
Early in Fernanda's stay in Denmark, she was housed in a men's unit of an asylum centre and was repeatedly abused.
I was raped, not once, but sometimes. It was a very difficult situation, and it's very traumatic for me to talk extensively about it, but all I can tell you is that I was really hurt.
There is a second Guatemalan transgender individual hoping that Denmark will look kindly on her plea for asylum. She has a dark, mysterious look with her hair falling over one eye and cascading way past her shoulders. Her name is Paula.
I can't really come back to my country. I can't. I'm 100% sure that I will be killed. Some people is waiting for me there, and I know it. Here, I'm totally safe.
If you could say something to the Danish authorities, what would you say to the government here about your case?
The only thing that I can say to them that if they can just give me the opportunity to have a life.
I am a transgender person, and most important, I am a human being. So I think that should be the issue in this case.
So will Paula and Fernanda be given a one-way ticket to Guatemala? Everything depends on whether the Danes accept that the chances of murder in Central America are too great to risk sending them back. Earlier this year, there was clear guidance on the matter of sexuality by the United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon, who said
It is our duty under the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to protect the rights of everyone, everywhere. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Copenhagen.
For more information, go to our webpage, dw.de.
Belgium is well known for its numerous beers and delicious chocolate. But it is also famous, though perhaps less so today, as the home of the modern comic strip, with Tintin, the Smurfs, and Lucky Luke all hailing from there. Now, in recent decades, Belgium has lost ground to other countries in its comic strip output. But as Don Duncan reports from Brussels, it's starting to fight back.
During the recent annual Belgian Comic Book Festival, enormous balloons featuring comic strip characters paraded down the main streets of Brussels. Roadrunner sauntered along, followed by a bouncy SpongeBob SquarePants. But despite the cheer, there was something missing. In Brussels, the birthplace of the modern comic strip, not one of these parading gigantic balloons were of Belgian characters. Until the 1970s, Belgium was the king of the comic strip, with comic magazines like Tintin and Spirou selling a quarter of a million copies a week. But things have changed since that golden age, says comic book historian Thierry Belfoy.
There's now a very striking disconnect between the grand golden age and what the Belgian comic books have become today.
Today, most of the big Belgian comic book publishing houses have been bought up by multinationals. And the country's comic strip output has been dwarfed by new players like Japan and Argentina, as well as by old heavies like the US and France. But Belgium has started fighting back.
It's essential to be able to support people who can take time to explore new graphic modes of expression, new forms of narrative, new ways to step outside the box.
That's Bruno Merckx, director of Belgium's Comic Book Commission, a government body set up in 2007 with an annual budget of €130,000 for the promotion of new Belgian comic strip art. The commission funds 30 to 40 projects a year, with grants of between €1,000 and €10,000. The products of this effort tower on the bookshelves behind Merckx in his office, but the work does not stop there.
The symbolic element of all this is that this helps the comic strip emerge from the category of subculture or subgenre. A comic book author is a literary author in his own right.
The internet is perhaps the next holy grail in comic book publishing. And unlike in text-based publishing sectors like novels, comic book publishers have yet to agree on a format standard for e-comics. And that could be where small Belgian e-publishers like GrandPapier.org come in.
Grand Papier, l'idée c'était de...
Grand Papier is an idea to bring the things we want to read together in one place and to be able to offer an online publication platform to other comic book authors.
Sacha Gerg, founder of GrandPapier.org, says the site has about 400 contributors and has published some 2,000 comic book stories since it started 5 years ago. It now gets 400 readers a day and is planning to develop an e-comic format for comic books that will be adopted by the major publishing houses.
We have a crazy project. We want to see how we can manage to automatically generate digital formats from comic stories posted to our site, so people can either go on grandpapier.org or download a comic book as an ebook.
The commercial world of comic books has changed since the heyday of Tintin, Spirou, and the Smurfs. But while big business decisions may now be made in Paris or London, Brussels can still play a major role in exploring new aesthetic and technological frontiers. If Belgium succeeds to gain an edge in this respect, we may well be seeing a few more giant balloon figures of new Belgian comic strip characters parade the streets during the annual comic book festival in years to come. Don Duncan, DW, Brussels.
There are calls in Britain for one of the country's most vilified monarchs to get a state funeral if bones found in an archaeological dig in Leicester turn out to be those of King Richard III. The medieval king died at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485 in the last showdown between the ancient houses of Lancaster and York, commonly known as the War of the Roses. His life and brutal demise have been shrouded in controversy for nearly five centuries, and now his remains are even causing a stir. From England, our correspondent Kev McLean has this report.
A horse. My kingdom for a horse.
Withdraw, my lord. I'll help you to a horse.
Ah, slave! I have set my life upon a cast.
King Richard III has long been a favourite of English literature and drama. His character mythologised many times, most famously, of course, by Shakespeare.
A horse. A horse. My kingdom for a horse!
Controversy and intrigue has always surrounded his life. Accusations he murdered two young princes in the Tower of London is widely debated, and he's often characterised as a ruthless figure with a hunchback. But who is the real King Richard III of England? Well, following an archaeological dig in the city of Leicester, we might just be about to find out.
I think it's amazing that we, after all these years, 520-something years, have decided to dig an archaeological dig.
Leicester resident Andy Brooks.
So amazing that it was just in the right place, that we have two human remains, one female, one male, with the kind of injuries and deformities that makes it possible that it was King Richard III. It's in the right place. He was alleged after the 1485 Battle of Bosworth to be being put in that area in the Greyfriars Inn town. When that area became a private house, there was a mark in the garden to say, here lies the body of Richard III. It then became a school and then the social services department of the city council. And here we are in 2012. We've got a hole, we've got some bones, and we don't know. We've got to wait until the DNA comes through. It's exciting if it is Richard. It's even more exciting if it isn't in some ways.
We're currently in Leicester Cathedral, which is in the centre of the city. We're stood by the memorial plaque to Richard III.
That's Councillor Patrick Kittrick, a local politician who represents the city of Leicester.
I'm reading King of England killed at Bosworth Field in this county on the 22nd of August 1485. And somewhat accurately, it says buried in the church of the Greyfriars in this parish. We actually didn't know where the bones of King Richard III were buried. But we do believe that we've located it now within the Greyfriars area, and it's a big archaeological find. We're here at the High Altar, and in front of us is a portrait of King Richard III. In Shakespearean plays, he was portrayed as a villain, but actually quite a lot of people, and quite a lot of people connected with Leicester, believes that was a caricature of him and that he wasn't quite the villain that Shakespeare made him out to be. In the picture, you know, we see a picture of a king, but minus the hump that Shakespeare gave him. When we've looked at the archaeological finds, the bones we've found does suggest that he probably did have some curvature of the spine, but not the humpback devil that's portrayed in Tudor plays.
Patrick took us to the spot where the remains were found to explain some more about the discovery.
First of all, they found the altar, which is usually where somebody of the king's status would be buried. And then they found some bones. And the key clues that it might be Richard III were a battle wound to the head, which he sustained at Bosworth Field, and the fact that he had a condition called scoliosis, which actually leads to a curvature of the spine.
There's been speculation Richard III's remains may exist under the city of Leicester for years, but this discovery has caught some rather experienced people by surprise.
I said at the beginning of the project, when people asked me privately whether I thought we'd be successful in finding Richard III, I said there was pretty well no chance. It was a million to one chance, and that, yes, I'd eat my hat if we did find him.
That's another Richard, Richard Buckley, the co-director of the University of Leicester's Archaeological Services. He's overseeing the investigation into the remains.
So you can imagine when I was told that that we had found indeed found a burial that had a lot of these attributes, I was completely stunned and in a bit of a state of shock for a while, I think, and uttered quite a few expletives, I have to say, which I can't repeat. But yes, and one of my colleagues did indeed bake me some hat-shaped cakes to eat, so I have eaten those.
We won't know until at least Christmas the exact identity of the bones found under a car park in the ancient city of Leicester. But there are already suggestions from some senior British politicians that if they do turn out to be Richard III's remains, a state funeral should be held for the medieval monarch. But what do the people of Leicester make of it all?
It's quite exciting that they've found them,
yeah.
But I think it's probably cost an awful lot of money.
All I know, it was a weird spine with half an arrow in it.
Do you think it's a good thing for Leicester that the remains have been found here?
Yes. Puts our name on the map, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think anything that's, you know, historical and we find new things, it's got to be good, isn't it?
What about if some people talk about a state funeral for King Richard that could happen in Leicester? What do you think about that?
Make sure it's the right bones first, but then I think it'd be lovely.
Kev McLean, DW, England.
And I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. Stay tuned to Inside Europe if you want to find out what kind of bird you are when it comes to email communication. Birds. Wonderful creatures who, going all the way back to the pterodactyl in the dinosaur era, are truly prehistoric. Yet they can tell us so much about who we are, even in our modern world of instant communication. In fact, they can tell us much more than you may have thought. That's at least according to two Scottish researchers who've used different types of birds to describe the way we use email. Are you one of those people who checks their email nonstop? Well, then you're the compulsive woodpecker. Do you send abusive emails? Then you're the boorish parrot. Do you respond immediately and expect the same of others? Then you're the lightning response hummingbird. These are just three of the 12 types laid out by Judith Ramsey of University of West of Scotland and Karen Renaud of Glasgow University. We've got Karen on the line right now. What type are you?
Oh, I'm a compulsive woodpecker. I can tell you that without even thinking twice. I have a very bad habit of reading email first thing in the morning when I get up. And a number of years ago, I had some software running on my machine that would give me a graph of what I was doing. And I noticed when I looked at the graph that I had been switching between other things and email all day. So it was kind of bouncing forth like a ping pong ball. And I was quite shocked by that. And so I started to do this research with a friend of mine at the University of West of Scotland, Judith Ramsey. And so she and I started to study this data that I was getting because I recorded some other people too. And it just seems that some people are more prone to being a bit compulsive when it comes to their email.
Mm.
Yes.
Normally, when we contact people for interviews, we definitely do it over the phone. But this time, I just had to send an email. Now, in my email, I tried to be as polite as possible.
Uh-huh.
What type of bird would that make me?
You're getting close to being a robin.
And what about the robin?
Well, I've called that the popular robin because he takes the time to not depersonalize people. When he does write emails, it's only when he has to. If he can speak to the people personally, he does that. But when he does write an email, he thinks about who he's sending it to and the effect that the email is going to have on that person.
Now, of course, your colleague, Professor Judith Ramsey, did get back to me. But
yes.
Had she not, she would have been an incommunicado ostrich.
Indeed.
Which would have forced me to send another inquiry, making me the pesky crow.
The pesky crow is more, I would think, in a work environment. I don't know if you have people, if you worked with people like this, where they ask you to do something and then within 2 hours they're asking you again by email whether you've done it. And, you know, that sort of behavior. So that's what I meant by a pesky crow. I'm not sure what you would be if you were. Maybe we need to come up with a nagging bird.
A nagging bird. Well, let me finally get to the question I was trying to ask.
Okay.
Why bird types? What is it specifically that made you include them in your study?
Well, it just seemed we had a person here in the department. He's retired now, but he was a bird aficionado. He knew all the kinds of birds. And we were chatting one day about my email work, and I said, oh, could you help me? You know, I want to do this, match these behaviors to birds. And we had a great time. And it seems like it's really struck a chord with people, because a lot of people can understand, you know, a buck passing cuckoo, because the cuckoo is the bird that lays its egg in another bird's nest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that sort of seemed to fit quite well.
So had your colleague been into spiders, for instance?
I don't know spiders well enough. But it also felt like the kinds of birds I used are very well known in Britain anyway. I'm not sure how well known they are in the rest of the world. And people immediately said, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So
you're convinced that the way we use email does indeed say something about our individual personalities?
It just seemed like it was that we're categorizable, that you could, you know, that people have distinctive ways of using email. Perhaps, you know, some people have distinctive ways of using their mobile phones. Other people have distinctive ways of doing other things, you know, the way they want their kitchens in their house and so on. But it seemed like, you know, that we have particular recognizable behaviors when it came to email. And I can basically name a lot of my colleagues here. Not good or bad, but just distinctive ways of doing things.
Could you draw comparisons from your research between the way people communicate face-to-face and the way they use email?
I didn't try to do that. I what really concerns me about email is that people will do things by email that they wouldn't necessarily do to your face. So if somebody doesn't feel like doing a job, they might dump it on you by email, where they wouldn't come into your office and do that to you. They would ask very nicely if they came into your office. And so I think email allows people to behave a little bit badly sometimes.
Indeed. Most of the birds that you used in the study denote rather negative characteristics. We've got boorish, pesky, incommunicado, compulsive, hoarding, camouflaging. Do we all have to change the way we use email?
It's very easy not to be self-aware. In fact, the school I went to had as its motto, know thyself. And I've often thought about that motto now that I'm an adult and long out of school. And it's just about, you know, thinking before you send an email, is this the best way of communicating? And if it is the best way, can I do it in as nice a way as possible so the person who receives it doesn't get upset? Because people think that email is free, but it's not free for the recipient. You know, that person has to open it, they have to process it, it takes their time, and time is not free.
So think before you click, you
think
would say.
Think before, exactly. Yes, I actually published a paper called that, exactly that, a few years ago.
Karen Renaud speaking there from Glasgow on the burden of email.
Rise up this morning, smile with the rising sun.
Now, when tourists flock to Italy, they often say it's to deepen their knowledge of art and antiquities in its many museums. But let's be honest here. We know they're really going for the tasty treat that awaits them after the museum, gelato. Now, without any guilt, they can get their museum and gelato fix all in one go. The first museum dedicated to artisan gelato has just opened outside Bologna. The free museum will be a celebration of gelato as it was made hundreds of years ago and today. Nancy Greenlees has the scoop.
A museum dedicated to this magical mix of milk, sugar, cream, and more is as sensible as a cool cone on a sweltering summer day. After all, Italians and visitors already have done extensive gelato research. They've tried the peach flavor. They've scrutinized the cherry. They've excavated every last dribble in a cup of chocolate chip. Valentina Righi of the Carpigiani Gelato Museum says it's long awaited.
Il museo realizza tanti sogni. Il gelato è un sogno, è un sogno per I bambini.
The museum makes many dreams come true. Gelato is a dream for children whose eyes light up when they're eating a gelato. A dream for adults who relive their childhood when they're eating a gelato. It rarely happens that I'll meet a person who, when I talk about gelato, gives me a disgusted look.
The museum is a project of the Carpigiani Foundation, the nonprofit arm of the leading manufacturer of artisan gelato machines. Artisan gelato shops make fresh gelato every day on site and sell it to the public. The museum is sweet publicity for Carpigiani, but General Manager Andrea Cocchi says their motivation was a sense of responsibility to the industry made up of mostly small mom-and-pop shops.
I believe that when you know your history, your roots, you look towards the future with more confidence and understanding.
Gelato's history, culture, and technology is presented in a light-filled, airy space inside Carpigiani's Bologna headquarters. The interactive museum offers audiovisual presentations of those who made gelato into an Italian must-eat. The guided tours take visitors into reconstructed laboratories from eras past, stocked with tools of the trade, such as gelato molds. For nearly 40 years, museum curator Luciana Poliotti has studied artisan gelato. Yet the former industry magazine editor says gelato's history remains a tantalizing mystery.
Who invented gelato? I'm always asked this. No one. It's like pasta and bread. There's no mum or dad.
But certain cultures acted as foster parents, molding gelato into what's plopped onto cones today. The Gelato Museum traces the history, beginning in 12,000 BC, when ancient Greeks mixed the cool water from a cavern spring with garlic and herbs. In Mesopotamia, snow was transported from the mountains for chilling beverages during royal banquets. And Poliotti says flavors came into their own in the 11th century.
The Arabs invented an amazing thing, sugar syrup, lo sharab. When they conquered Sicily, they brought with them the cultivation of cane sugar. In Palermo, they grew 400 different types of flowers, since the flower petals were used to flavor their sorbet.
Historians get whipped up about whether the first gelato as we know it was created for Caterina de' Medici, the 16th century Florentine noblewoman. Poliotti did her homework, but won't reveal the answer until the museum opens. She will, however, praise Francesco Procopio Couto, a fisherman who inherited his grandfather's gelato machine. In the 1600s, the Sicilian opened a cafe that offered Italian gelato, not in Italy, but France.
How incredibly important was his contribution, and how complicated it was to make gelato in Paris. It was very difficult.
As evidence, Poliotti points to a bulky wooden machine that she says dates back to the late 1800s.
Questa qua è una macchina fine 800, no?
She grips a wheel that she says clears the cooled mixture from the inside of the canister. It falls to the bottom and with a centrifugal force is sprayed anew on the sides, creating what she calls sublime gelato. Ancient machines such as this one, along with modern pasteurizers and batch freezers, are on display. Next year, school children should be able to get sticky at the King Cone of field trips. Carpigiani expects the museum will be a hit, judging from the success of its other initiative, Gelato University, where enrollment has steadily increased since 2009, despite the economic crisis. Valentina Righi says the museum, just like the university, wants visitors to leave having absorbed one very important detail.
Please, call it gelato. Don't call it ice cream.
This made-in-Italy masterpiece has less fat, many would argue more flavor, and is made for immediate consumption. Near the end of the tour, visitors will get their just desserts. Free samples of coffee gelato and strawberry currant gelato as it was made in the 1800s and how it's made today. Nancy Greenlease, DW Radio, Rome.
Well, I'd say it's time for an Italian treat. Yummy, yummy, yummy. At any rate, that's all the time we have for this week. Hope you liked the program. It was produced with help from sound engineers Marianne Kulina and Christoph Gruva and my colleague Neil King. If you have any feedback, feel more than free to drop us a line. Our email address is europe@dw.de. We always love to hear from you. For me, Gabriel Borud, and the rest of the team, goodbye. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.